Greetings, all your 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, and the show is Alternative Visions. We've moved here to a Saturday format venue at 1 p.m. Eastern time. I hope folks have been able to listen to the promos we've been running, announcing the move and the change. And unfortunately, if you looked up on the website today, you would see a different show, so we don't quite have everything worked out in terms of announcements, but hopefully you'll tune in and you'll figure out that the show is still on today. And it's an important show. I want to talk about China in more depth. What's going on in China? This is going to be an extension of my show last time, well, 2 weeks ago, actually, where we talked about the global emerging perfect storm. What's a perfect storm? That's when three major weather fronts converge, you know, like Hurricane Sandy. And I'm talking about a perfect global economic storm, which means we have three new problem areas emerging in the world. And we are moving to a third phase of the global economic crisis, which hasn't disappeared. It's just moved around, morphed and moved around the globe. First phase in the U.S. in 2007-9, banking crash 2008, followed by a very weak historical recovery in the U.S., less than half of normal, which is still continuing after 5 years. But we bailed out the banks. Not the rest of us, but the banks at least. Then the second phase of the global crisis moves in 2010-12 to Europe, and the banking problems and sovereign debt problems and depressions in the periphery of Europe and the double-dip recession in Europe that occurs, first dip along with the U.S., a very brief weak recovery in 2010, and then it goes into another recession and just recently sort of recovered from that recession in Europe. But not much of a recovery if you think 0.3% GDP growth is a recovery. Then I guess they've, quote, recovered. But if you properly estimate and properly define what a recession is, they haven't recovered. Anyway, stagnation at best in Europe, indicated by a growing drift towards deflation, falling prices. You never get recovery when you have falling prices. Okay, that's the second front. The third front is emerging markets. That's the worst weather front. You know, that's the one that's coming down from Greenland here and hitting the East Coast. Emerging markets, big problems with capital flight, currency collapse, so forth. And China is part of emerging markets. You could argue that, but it's a special case of emerging markets, not quite in the same category. You know, there are several key regions around the world economically. There's North America, there's Europe, Eurozone, European Union. There are emerging markets, countries like Brazil, Indonesia, Turkey, South Africa, etc. Those are called emerging markets, not necessarily undeveloped, rapidly developing or were, etc. So that's the third region. Then you could identify Japan as a little bit different, not really an emerging market, of course, and not really an independent economic entity as far as global trends are concerned, but you could make that argument. And then you got China, which is was part of emerging markets, but is really developed a $10 trillion economy that's kind of on its own. So, you know, about four or five key areas in the globe, and they don't always move in the same direction, but we got constant problems in all of them. and now emerging in China. So we want to look at China as a special case. What's going on in China, and why is it so important? And that's the topic of our discussion today. So let's jump right into that topic. First of all, what's happening in China? Economic growth is definitely slowing fast. Okay. 14% GDP growth in 2007. Now, barely 7%, and projections are even less, and it could be significantly less in 2014. It all depends upon what happens with the rest of the global economy and what happens with emerging markets and what happens in the banking system, including the shadow banking system in China, which we're going to talk about shortly and explain. That's the first problem, slowing growth. And, you know, China, $10 trillion economy, when China slows, so does a host of other countries that China buys from. I'm talking about, the emerging markets. China buys a lot of goods, raw materials, raw resources, and semi-finished goods, for example, from Brazil and South Africa and Australia and a host of other countries. Well, when China slows, so do they slow. And those emerging markets are also slowing, in addition, because capital is flowing out at a rapid pace, going back to the, quote, West, unquote, here. So there's a double whammy on the emerging markets, China slowing and the money flowing. Okay, that's one problem, slowing growth in China. Another problem is in its currency, the currency called the yuan, sometimes called the renminbi. Let's just call it yuan, easier to pronounce. Currency collapse. Well, maybe not collapse, but all of a sudden now we got a fast decline in the currency, the yuan. What does that mean? Why is that a source of instability? Well, we'll talk about that shortly. But that's a second problem here. And it's a reversal of a other problem with regard to currency up until recently, and that was steadily rising value of the yuan. And we'll explain how that ties into speculation and debt in China and the growing financial bubbles and problems. Now, with currency declining, looks like an unwinding of that debt might occur, which is very dangerous if it gets out of control. Okay, that's the second problem. Currency volatility and decline. Third problem, debt at record levels in China. Levels that, when they have occurred before, historically, in the U.S., Korea, and elsewhere, they always led to a financial crash. Debt levels. Local government, housing, and project debt in particular. I'm not talking about consumer debt. Although consumption is rising in China, people are using credit cards more. I'm talking about housing debt and local government project and investment debt. Okay, now that's going to be tied into the shadow bank problem that's growing and the currency speculation problem. So debt and currency speculation are tied together. Okay, and we'll talk about that. And the fourth problem, also tied to currency debt levels, is bubbles, financial bubbles, price bubbles in housing, in construction of all kinds, in real estate, in local government. Bubbles, financial bubbles. They all go together. Rising debt, shadow banks, currency speculation, financial bubbles, real estate speculation. Looks very much like what was happening in the West in 2005 and 6 in some ways. Some ways different. Okay, but growing indications of financial instability while economic growth is slowing. Dangerous combination. Okay, how do we understand financial instability in China? Well, first of all, we got to understand this phenomenon called the shadow banks, global shadow banks, and their penetration of China since 2010. Right? Massive inflows of speculative hot money. That's feeding the bubbles and the booms in the housing and projects, local government. Big hot money inflows. and they are accelerating. In 2011, for example, only $16 billion of money inflows into China. 2013, $242 billion. All that kind of money flowing into any economy is not going to result in real investment that creates real jobs and real GDP growth. It's always an indication that that hot money is going into financial speculation, and that's what's happening in China. And we're beginning to see some of the early indications of the problems with this in some troubled industries and the banks and shadow banks associated with them that are now, well, actually, some of them have defaulted technically and been bailed out, and others are to come. Defaults are always a consequence when bubbles burst, and we are sort of at the beginning of that possibility in China. Okay, so what's happening in China is slowing real economic growth for a number of reasons we'll talk about, and growing problems in the financial sector, particularly local government and housing, bubbles, price bubbles, debt-driven price bubbles, and currency problems and volatility, also due to speculation. All right, so why is China important? Well, first of all, it's a $10 trillion economy. Second largest in the world. We're $17 trillion in the U.S. They're $10 trillion. I think the next closest would be Japan, somewhere around $6 trillion. Okay. China growth, as I've already said, is key to emerging market growth, to propping up emerging markets. There's a kind of a dual global development that has been underlying the growth of emerging markets for the last decade. And that dual development is a lot of money capital flowing from the West, from the U.S. and Europe and Japan, into these emerging markets to stimulate investment, to boost their resources and their industries, intermediate goods and natural resources, in countries like Brazil, South Africa, Australia, South America, so forth. And that hot money, investment money, finances the growth in those emerging markets of industries that then sell their goods to China. China is resource poor, and China has been going around the world getting all these resources from these emerging markets. So China's demand for real goods, Western money, providing the development to deliver those real goods, that's the dual relationship behind emerging markets. Now, emerging markets are going in a tank. Well, for the same two reasons. The capital, the money capital from the West is flowing back. That has to do with Western Federal Reserve and other central bank policies now. That money is flowing out. At the same time, China is slowing, so the demand for China, by China, for goods from Brazil and so forth is declining. So those countries, emerging market economies, are getting hit with a double whammy right now. And that's why they will really continue to slow, and problems will develop and multiply in those economies. That's what I meant when I said the emerging perfect storm and the worst of the three storms, China slowdown, Europe deflation drift, emerging markets is the latter, emerging markets. So when China growth slows, those countries have even a greater problem. Now, China is also key to Europe and its economies, particularly Germany, which is at the core of the euro economy and is the only thing that's been keeping the eurozone from even greater problems, Germany's production and its exports. I'm not going to talk again about the key relationship between German exports within the eurozone and how that has contributed to the problems in the eurozone periphery. But the point here is Germany exports a lot of products. Perhaps its most, its biggest trading partner is China. Yes, Germany exports to China. So if China slows down, German exports will take a hit as well, and then so will the Eurozone economy, because Germany's holding it up with its export policies. Okay, so China is important, not only for emerging markets, but China growth is important for the Eurozone economy and its ability or inability to recover robustly from its double-dip recession that had just ended and barely any recovery going on. Okay, now what else? Why else is China important? China is important because it massively invests in other countries around the world. Okay, China has also pumped money into the emerging markets to develop those industries like agriculture and energy and so forth in Latin America, Africa, and places like that to ensure those goods that it needs, resources, come to China. Foreign direct investment is what we call this. This is money flows, not export good flows, but money flows from China into these emerging markets. Now, China is also increasingly investing in Europe and the U.S. Money flows to drive investment in these other countries. Okay, what about Europe? If you look at Europe, China is investing big time in the U.K., United Kingdom, particularly in real estate, and especially in energy. They are building ports, expanding London ports, docks, and so forth. London real estate is in a boom, is in a bubble of its own, because of money flowing from China and from all elsewhere in emerging markets that are coming back from emerging markets, and is causing a construction boom and bubble in the London, South England area, which is responsible for most of the UK recovery. In other words, it's a pretty artificial recovery built on speculation and growth in housing and commercial properties, and also nuclear energy. The UK Prime Minister Cameron announced that he was going to develop nuclear energy, and China's underwriting it. In other words, financing it, and port facilities and so forth. It's ironic, isn't it? Once the center of the global most powerful capitalist empire at the time in the 19th, early 20th century, the UK, England, now is so dependent upon capital coming back to it in order to keep its head above the water. Okay. Also, China is important for Europe because it has been buying bonds, government bonds of those countries in the southern periphery of Europe, you know, Spain and Italy and so forth, that were in deep doo-doo. Their bonds, you know, were collapsing, and they have a big deficit problem there because of, to some extent, Germany, but we won't talk about that. But China's been coming in and buying up the bonds, stabilizing the periphery. So if China has economic problems, you know, will it not invest as much in the Eurozone? Will it not buy as many bonds from the Eurozone? Will cause further weakening in the Eurozone. So China is critical both for emerging markets and the Eurozone. China is also investing more in the United States. China is desperately seeking energy resources around the world, and that includes discussions in the U.S. and that appendage of the U.S. economy called Canada. If you peel back the onion enough, you will see all this XL pipeline stuff and the Canadian oil shale and you know, our exploitation of shale oil everywhere in the U.S., well, many places in the U.S., which is destroying our water table. Behind that is exports to China. China wants U.S. energy exports. And all this production of shale gas and so forth and oil sands is not to reduce the price of and the cost to consumers in the U.S. of energy. That's all going to go offshore, or most of it. You're not going to see any benefit to that, but, you know, big companies and capitalists in the U.S. like the Koch brothers, who are big investors in all this pipeline stuff and energy development, they're going to get even richer than they are, if you can believe richer than they are. Okay. China has also been buying U.S. bonds, treasury bonds. And that's been keeping, for the last 6-7 years, the government afloat. Actually, a little bit before that. This is what we call the twin deficits. Now, listen to this. Okay, the U.S. agrees to let China trade with the U.S. This is, you know, late 90s when China entered the WTO, right? Low-cost Chinese goods flood the U.S. markets. U.S. companies move their growth, manufactured goods, to China. Right, we lose high-paying jobs here, manufacturing jobs in the U.S., right? But we can buy all this cheap stuff at Walmarts because the China stuff comes in and it's lower cost because they pay such lower wages over there. Okay, that creates, though, what's called a trade deficit with China. Hundreds of billions a year, we have a trade deficit with China. In other words, they buy less from us than we buy from them, so money flows out of the U.S. But that money comes back to the U.S. from China as China buys government bonds. So U.S. politicians know this money is coming back in the hundreds of billions of every year, as long as China keeps buying the bonds. So politicians know they can run a budget deficit in the U.S. because they can get that money back from China. In fact, so much of it is going to China and recycling back that they figure, well, you know, we can finance wars without raising taxes, which is what they've done for the last decade. And we can even give tax cuts to the rich folks at the same time, which is what they've done. It's all because of the twin deficits. U.S. runs a trade deficit in order for it to run a budget deficit. Called the twin deficits. We are connected at the hip with the Chinese economy and the circulation of dollars. Right? China also buys U.S. exports, and China FDI in the U.S. is increasing as well. So there's an important relationship economically between China and the U.S., isn't there? Yes. And if China sinks or has trouble financially or in terms of growth, that will affect the U.S. Now, six, why else is China important? Because China currency is on a long-term trend to become a rival to the U.S. dollar as a global reserve and trading currency. Okay, so some really big reasons why China is important, isn't it? To Europe, to emerging markets, you know, to the U.K., to the U.S., and to the globe. And if China's problems, slowing economic growth, rising debt, currency problems and volatility, and financial asset bubbles in housing and construction, and financial instability continues to worsen, then the consequences could be significant. Right. A little bit about the dimensions of the first part here, the China GDP growth slowdown that's occurring. We've talked a little bit about that, but let me say a little bit more, and that will bring us to the bottom hour, and then we'll take a short break before we come back and talk about Chinese currency and financial instability. Okay, China GDP growth and slowdown. As I said before, 14% before the global crisis, 2007-8-9, right? Now, somewhere around 7.5%, perhaps. Now, the Chinese Prime Minister said 7.2% is kind of like a floor. Well, what do we mean by that? That means if it falls below growth in China, below 7%, China has a problem absorbing new people entering the labor force. In other words, growing unemployment will be the result. And unemployment in China can be a big problem, big volatility problem, because we're talking about millions of people every year leaving the countryside, coming to the cities, looking for jobs. Yes. So they got to keep growing at 7%, or they're in trouble. Now, independent economists and sources estimate that this 7.5% today is even overestimated because of the way they gather their numbers, and that growth in China is really less than 7%, maybe 6.5%. Okay. And if it goes much lower, of course, it means even worse problems. China's strategy for economic growth is manufacturing and export those manufactured goods, and at the same time, the government invest deeply in infrastructure and in manufacturing in the country. Okay, so government investment, direct investment, something that virtually does not exist in the U.S., plus manufacturing and exports is the key. Government investment is about 45% at least of China GDP. Ours is about 10% or less. Well, I mean, not government investment, but private investment is 10% and less, right? What we call real gross domestic investment. Much of that comes from China, I mean, from the government in China. In the U.S., it comes from private sources, virtually no government. They're about 45% of GDP. We're 10%. Consumers. In the U.S., consumers make up 70% of the economy. In China, 35%. What China wants to do is to shift from this heavy reliance on manufacturing exports and government direct investment to more consumer investment. This is a difficult transition. It's never been done without a slowing of economic growth anywhere before. Okay, but China is committed to moving in that direction. Which means there's going to be slower economic long-term growth in China, regardless of other factors that are slowing economic growth. Right? Okay. But that's not the only thing that's slowing economic growth in China. Slowing GDP growth in China is popping up as a result of China trying to tame the shadow banking sector, the global shadow banks and their speculators, who are causing these bubbles, as I've said, in the currency and housing markets and derivative markets now. Yes, slowing GDP due to taming the shadow banks' attempts and trying to slow these hot money inflows that feed the shadow banks and the speculation and the bubbles. Here's a figure. Local debt, I mean local mortgage, housing, government, local government project investments, remember government invests, in China, rose from $1.7 trillion to more than $5 trillion in just the last 2 years, between 2011 and 2013. Local debt. In other words, this reflects this massive inflow of hot money into China. It's going into their local markets and speculation in housing and local projects, and on top of that, financial derivatives that are being created. Some of it's also going in to speculate in the currency, the yuan. We'll talk about that. The shadow banks now represent 90% of all the debt increase since 2008. They were 25% of it. Of course, I heard a click here. Are we still on? Oh, okay. I think maybe this is a good time at the bottom. I think this is a good time at the bottom of the hour here to attempt to take a break here. And I'll repeat a little bit of this information about the elements of the slowdown in real growth in China here when we get back, and talk about currency volatility and financial instability in China. And speculation and what's happening in that regard. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions, and we'll be back with a continued discussion of China and instability and problems of growth there and what it means for the global economy.
Now sometimes tomorrow comes soaked in treasure and blood. Here we stood the job. Now we'll stand. and the flood. There's a new world coming. I can see the light. I'm a jack of all trades. We'll be all right.
Greetings once again. This is Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show's Alternative Visions, and we're taking a deep look into the problems in the Chinese economy. Okay, where we left off, we were talking about the slowing economic growth in China, which is continuing, and the implications of that for the rest of the global economy. Okay, and we talked about what were the causes of that slowing economic growth. And we talked to some extent about China trying to shift to a consumption-driven from an investment export-driven economic growth strategy, which always slows the economy. But we started talking about another cause of that. There's actually three causes. The second cause is China attempting to tame the shadow banking sector that has penetrated its economy since 2010. And in taming the shadow banks, by that we mean let's reduce the hot money inflows that are causing bubbles in the financial local government investment markets here and in derivatives and in their foreign exchange, their currency, the yuan. Hot money inflows, massive hot money inflows, that's behind that increase in local debt of from $1.7 trillion to over $5 trillion since 2010. That reflects that. And it's also reflected in the fact that the total debt increase in China, public and private, 90% of that since 2008 has been debt in these local markets and so forth, which means from the shadow banks and the hot money inflows. Now, the Central Bank of China, People's Bank of China, has been attempting to bring this under control by raising interest rates to cool down the economy and the speculation in housing. But it's not working. They've tried this a couple times since last year, summer last year, and each time they do it, it slows down the rest of the economy rather than having the greatest impact on the shadow banks and the hot money inflows behind the bubbles. Okay, they've done that on and off, on and off. Last summer, of course, they did it, and it resulted in a credit crunch, meaning, whoop, not enough money available for legitimate lending and investment outside these bubbles. Slows down the economy more rather than slowing down the hot money and the speculators. Okay, so that's a source. On again, off again, slowing GDP over the last year. This policy to cool off and tame the shadow banks, as I said, resulted in a credit crunch last year, which policymakers in China followed up with a fiscal stimulus, a mini stimulus. You know, if you go back to 2008, when the crash occurred across the world, China recovered very quickly because China, unlike the U.S., engaged in a direct government investment infrastructure boosting program that was equivalent to 15% of its GDP. Whereas here in the U.S., Obama's recovery program was 5% of GDP, much smaller amount than a much larger economy at the time. And most of that went to tax cuts for investors and businesses and or subsidies to the states in order to pay for unemployment benefits and so forth. So it was poorly timed and composed in the U.S. You can read all that in my 2012 book, Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few, published by Palgrave and Pluto Press. You can get it online or at my website, which is Kyklos Productions, KYKLOSProductions.com. Also on my blog, which is just jackrasmus.com. So if you're interested in that analysis and that comparison between the U.S. and why insufficient and poorly composed and timed stimulus in the U.S. resulted in this bouncing along the bottom and no real recovery we've had in the U.S. for 5 years compared to China's 15% and big, fast recovery by 2010, just go to my book and or to, you know, my blogs and website where I talk about all this deficit fiscal monetary policy stuff as well. Anyway, China policymakers three times tried to engage in this stop-go taming of since last year of the shadow banks and hot money inflows with little positive effect. Slows down their real economy, they kind of panic, they step back, and they re-stimulate the economy again with a mini-stimulus. That's going on right now, 2014. And the Chinese Communist Party will have its plenum here in March, where they'll decide on shifting to consumption. So we got two factors here exacerbating each other. Long-term shift to consumption, which will slow the economy, and attempts to tame the shadow banks, which also ends up slowing down the economy some. But they have to do that, or it'll be even worse later. Okay, so how much is the economy slowing down? Well, if you look at manufacturing, last seven months, it's been in a definite slowing, and now is contracting. Now, manufacturing is central to the Chinese economy. There is an indicator that's called the Purchasing Index, and if it's below 50, a number of 50, it means the economy is contracting, or the sector is contracting. If it's above 50, it means it's expanding. Well, it was barely expanding last fall, September, October, at 51, but it dropped to 49 in January, and it dropped to 48 in February. So very definitely this source of big source of Chinese economic growth, manufacturing, is slowing. Now, the third reason why it is slowing is because you have a slowdown in much of the rest of the world. In other words, Europe, source of significant Chinese exports and thus manufacturing, has been stagnant. So no growth there. And now the emerging markets are rapidly slowing, so less demand there for Chinese goods. So we have three major forces here that are converging, designed to slow down the Chinese economy. All right. And that's what's been occurring. Let's move on to the next big area problem, which is the China currency and volatility in China currency. Go back to 2010. That's when Obama and his advisors meet with the Chinese and their advisors. Now, China's booming in 2010, and the U.S. is slipping into a double dip. It doesn't show up in our indicators until first quarter of 2011. But I believe we had a double dip, very, very mild, or at least a stagnant situation in the first half of 2011. We actually had negative GDP first quarter 2011. I think that extended into the second quarter. I would say that was our double dip in early 2011. The economy in the U.S. also went flat at the end of 2012. Anyway, Obama and friends meet with the Chinese in 2010 and ask the Chinese to help out. Well, how would they help out? Well, by raising the value of their currency, the yuan, which would reduce their exports, make them less competitive with U.S. companies, and U.S. exports might be stimulated thereby. Okay, so help us out. Revalue your currency, China, and increase the amount of exports we can send to you. That was the request. Also, at the same time, China, please open up your financial system to Western banks, those two things. Now, China did both of those, right? China did both of those, and the yuan, their currency, began to consistently rise. Since 2010, it has risen by over 20%. You know, it's interesting, you know, you hear, you listen to liberal economists like Paul Krugman, you know, trying to blame China for all our problems and everything. And, oh, the Chinese are artificially keeping their currency value low and expanding their exports to our extent. Well, it's not true. China's been raising significantly the value of the yuan since 2010 to help out the United States and the economy. Well, other reasons, too, but, you know, it did help the U.S., at a critical point in time. And it did do what Obama wanted them to do. Now, the problem is, when the yuan and the currency is consistently rising, and you can count on it consistently rising, what that does is bring in shadow banks and very high net worth individual investors who will speculate in the rise in your currency. If they know it's going up, they're going to make money by betting on it continually going up. And boy, did they do that. They jumped in and they speculated on the yuan. And they started developing derivatives based on the rise of the yuan. In other words, secondary exploitation and speculation. And the shadow banks, you know, have rushed into China. It's very, very lucrative since 2010. Let's bring some money in there and let's speculate in the currency, and let's speculate in derivatives based on the currency, and let's speculate in rising real estate, local markets and everything. And they've got their claws into the Chinese financial system and are producing these bubbles. And China's having a hell of a time trying to extricate them from this kind of activity. Okay, and since 2010, okay, 2011, for example, we have this big surge in Chinese debt as a result of all this hot money inflow and speculation. And we have a surge in trading by global speculators in the Chinese currency called the yuan. And that's all driven by allowing the yuan to rise. Now, as China tries to get this thing under control, right, what is it now doing in recent months? It is engineering a decline, a fall in the yuan value. This is all about trying to get some control over their financial markets, runaway financial markets. It's also a response to slowing global exports and economy in China. In other words, let's boost our economy here while we're making this transition by making our goods even more competitive by lowering the value of our currency, right? So China is trying to build a firewall against the speculators as it's trying to boost its slowing economy, and that's what's behind the decline in the currency that's now going on. You know, it's kind of ironic. Think about it. The U.S. Complained for years, demanded that China allow the value of the yuan to rise because U.S. exports, this is all before 2008, were not competitive with China, right? Let your currency rise. Stop keeping it so low, right? And open up your banks to Western banking system, the Western banks. Okay. But as I said, that rising yuan brings in speculators and hot money inflows. Now the U.S. government and academics are complaining that, oh, China's engineering a decline in its currency, right? To cool off speculators and hot money. Yes, but now we're complaining about that. Well, you know, behind all this stuff about exports of goods and services with China lie the interest of finance capital. They make money not only on exports of goods and services, but they make big money on speculation. And the yuan rising brought in all the speculators and shadow banks, and now complaints about the yuan declining because it's going to perhaps push out the hot money and the speculators, now the U.S. is defending the shadow bank friends, right, who might be under pressure in China. You know, you can't win with the U.S. You know, they want it both ways, all times. And if you don't do it, you know, it's your fault, right? Okay, now, severe financial instability is a problem in China, right? And the U.S. is speaking on behalf of its shadow bank investors and friends, right, when it whines about the declining yuan in China. Western capitalists want to keep growing their shadow bank financial speculation in China, and therefore don't want the yuan to decline, right? That's an interesting development, right? China government is now engineering a decline to force losses on the shadow banks, discourage them from bringing more hot money in, to discourage, and I don't mean this hot money is just from the U.S. No, don't get me wrong, you know. Now with emerging markets in trouble and capital flight, a lot of that capital flight is flowing from Asian and Latin American emerging markets into China as well. China is putting up a wall to prevent that from flowing, and at the rate of $250 billion last 2012, into China and exacerbating their financial bubbles, right? Now, what's the role of debt in all of this? Well, it's important because when all this speculative money flows into a country, these speculators don't expend all of their own money, right? Investing in derivatives in the currency of the country. What they do is lend it out or borrow from each other. So we have rising debt going on at the same time in these markets. That's called leverage. When you borrow to invest and you use one of your own dollars and buy and borrow $9, that's leveraging, what we call. And speculation, financial asset speculation, is always based on high leveraging going on. And that causes a super run-up in the debt levels in these countries. Okay, and that's what's happening, as we said, in China, right? So a lot of the hot money inflows may be coming capital flight from the emerging markets today as well, right? You can't tame the shadow banks and speculators with traditional monetary policy and interest rate increases. That's the lesson of China. That's the lesson of the U.S. Since 2008 as well. Okay. Now, China moves towards slowing, cooling property bubble means prices will fall. Housing prices will, and they are turning around. There, we're growing 20% per year, local housing inflation. Right? We don't know what the inflation has been with the derivatives because it's not reported anywhere. But certainly, financial asset derivatives have been increasing in value. And, of course, we know the yuan appreciated 20%, right? Now, when it turns around, though, when the prices, the asset prices start falling, that means you are raising potential for defaults, right? When prices fall and your debt levels are still high, companies can't and investors there can't cover the cost of their debt payments when prices fall. Oh, that leads to defaults. Defaults have a psychological effect of causing a fear factor across sectors and the economy in general, and results in the disappearance of credit for real businesses and real economic growth. Defaults. When defaults start appearing and occurring, then you know you're getting close to a collapse of confidence. And we're beginning to see defaults in China as well. I'll explain that in just a few seconds here. All right, so who are these speculators, these shadow banks and these global investors pumping money into China? Who are they? Well, they're what we call ultra-high net worth individuals, investors. You know, shadow banks have doubled their total assets since 2008. While they, you know, governments are focusing on how to bring the banks to heel and financial regulation, the shadow banks have been expanding massively. There's over $71 trillion in shadow banking assets now around the world, double what it was in 2008, according to the business press. Right? And who are the shadow banks? Well, you know, we're talking about hedge funds, private equity firms, et cetera, all kinds of shadow banks. But the people behind them are the big financial capitalists, the ultra-high net worth individuals, they're called. Well, who are the unwees, as we'll call them? Who are these people who are, most of the shadow banking money is their money? You know, they move their money in and out of the shadow banks. They park it when it's not in the shadow banks and a couple dozen tax havens around the world. Then they move it in and out of the shadow banks to invest in this bubble, that bubble, et cetera. Who are these? Right? Well, over $30 trillion is the private asset money of the unwees. $30 trillion. That's supposed to go to $45 trillion by 2020. Right? 200,000 investors worldwide, about 70,000 in the U.S., 58,000 in Europe, 44,000 in Asia, 14,000 in Latin America, 1,000 in the rest of the world. 200,000. Okay. They move their money in and out of the shadow banks, parking it in tax havens in between, right? They invest directly themselves and or through the shadow banks. They are connected, the shadow banks, to the commercial banks as well. It's like a trifecta institutional relationship here. Big finance capitalists, shadow banks, and commercial banks who want to act like shadow banks desperately because that's where the big money is. Right? Total global financial wealth estimated in the world about $135 trillion. So $71 trillion of that is in the shadow banks, and maybe another $10-20 trillion of the high net worth individuals are in tax havens, and so two thirds, three fourths of the wealth of the world is held by 200,000 individuals in the world, and their wealth assets. I'm talking about investable assets, are up 8% or $12 trillion increase in 2012 alone, according to Boston Consulting. Fastest growth is in Asia. Okay? So all this money is flowing, has been flowing into China as their yuan has been appreciating and these bubble markets have been appearing. China's trying to stop it, put a firewall up because they expect even more to come in, trying to prick those financial bubbles before they burst, a la 2008, as in the U.S. Every time they do it, they slow their economy, as they're trying to shift their economy anyway, and as the rest of the world is stagnating or slowing. And now this whole effort is beginning to produce some defaults. Recently, we saw a shadow bank in China called the China Credit Trust, which has been loaning to mining and manufacturing and steel companies some of its derivative products and loans defaulted. These companies could not pay the shadow bank and investors, and they were about to default, and the government had to step in. And the default also can spread to the regular non-shadow banking sector, as we saw with the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China. Right, the lines between them are very fluid, all of them. So contagion is a problem if these bubbles burst. Contagion from the shadow banks in China to the regular banks in China, and defaults and problems in the non-banking sector, particularly manufacturing and industrial production. Now, the Chinese government has stepped in and bailed out these imminent defaults that have occurred here recently, just in recent months. In other words, signaling too big to fail is a problem in China as well as in the U.S. Right? Now, but when China bails them out, it gives a signal that, you get in trouble, you over-speculate and so forth, it doesn't matter, we'll bail you out. Oh, moral hazard, as they call that. Which gives a boost to speculators to say, we'll be bailed out, don't worry. Hmm? So that's what we got going on there. And debt in China has risen from 130% of GDP to 230% of GDP. Most of that is shadow banking private sector debt. Okay, big problem. Beginning to look like China is drifting towards its own Lehman moment, you might say. We will watch China very closely to see if its financial instability and slowdown, which affects the whole world, is going to exacerbate and get worse. It is a wild card in the global economic system, which is beginning to get shaky, both in real terms and financial terms. We got to watch China closely as the emerging markets really emerge as the main focal point of global financial instability and slowdown coming. This all will affect Europe and the U.S. is going to be very interesting, as well as that outlier called Japan. But we'll be looking at this more. But next week, we want to focus a little bit different. I'm going to have guests out. We're going to talk about what's happening in the Ukraine, to the economy in Ukraine, and, of course, the politics. Crony capitalist for Western capitalists. Big trade-off. What's that going to mean for the global world? Ukraine, the most basket case in the global economy. Okay, this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. I hope you're able to get to the show, and we will talk next week.